Good morning. It is Monday, November 10th, 2025. We're here for the 8:30 docket in case number 25-90160, Sonova Energy International. We'll go ahead and take appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. John Lozano with Bracewell LLP on behalf of the debtors. I'm joined today by my colleague Jason Cohen and by my co-counsel at Kirkland Ellis, Brian Schartz, Margaret Rainey, Mike Koch, and Gem Schreiber.
All right, thank you. All right, who else wishes to make an appearance? Go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me, Your Honor?
I can hear you, yes, sir.
Good morning. Henry Cavang with Pachulski, Stang, Zeal, and Jones for Winmar PV Energy and Winmar Home Florida, a dealer in Puerto Rico and Florida.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Andrew Jimenez for the United States Trustee.
Okay. Let me just... Mr. Galani, I could not hear you. Still can't hear you.
Good morning,
you.
Your Honor. Sorry. Good morning, Your Honor. I've been with the Castro for Itron Incorporated. A creditor in the case.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Daniel Sabal from Cobra and Kim. I'm here with my colleague, Martine Swarneray. We represent the Special Committee of the Board of Directors of Sonova International.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Aaron Kolodny from White & Case LLP on behalf of the Atlas Lenders. Hopefully a bit better.
Good morning. I can hear you. I can hear you that time. Let me just go around.
Good, all right.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honor. Dennis Jenkins, Wilkie Farr Gallagher on behalf of the committee.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor. Eric Dauscher from Nordgross Fulbright on behalf of Sunstrong Management.
Good morning. All right. Anyone else wish to make an appearance? Okay. All right. Mr. Lozano is going to take the lead.
Good morning, Your Honor. Again, for the record, John Lozano on behalf of the debtors. Mr. Schartz and his team will take the lead for us, but I'll hand that off in a moment. First, I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank the court for working with us on scheduling. As always, we appreciate the court and Mr. Laws working with us, and we believe we used the time rescheduling this hearing very productively. So without further comment from me, Your Honor, I'll hand it off to Mr. Schartz.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Well, Your Honor, Brian Schartz, Kirkland Ellis, Council of Debtors, please let me know if you can't hear me.
I can hear you fine.
Okay. If it's okay, I'm going to make a brief statement sort of in the form of an opening. Before we dive into the agenda, I do want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing since we saw you on the plan about 8 weeks ago. We have a short presentation. I believe the presenter name on the photo meeting is Kirkland Ellis, New York. If you could make them a presenter, we can put that up on the screen very quickly.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and activate the hand-raising feature because we're getting a lot of background noise. So hit 5-star one time if you wish to speak.
Conference muted.
Okay, can you hear me, Judge?
I can.
Thank you so much. If we could just go to this next slide here. Look, so after several adjournments of this hearing, for which we do thank Your Honor and for the court, for the flexibility and patience, especially in the midst of the government shutdown, that hopefully will end soon, we're here today to seek final approval of the debtor's disclosure statement, which the court conditionally approved on September 12th, and confirmation of the plan. And Judge, I'm pleased to report that we have used the time productively, and I believe, knock on wood, that other than with respect to the arguments that the U.S. Trustee's office previewed at the conditional DS hearing, I think we're consensually resolved on both the plan and disclosure statement. Hopefully I don't eat that pronouncement, but I think we're in very good shape. I want to talk for a moment about how we got here. And I think every good confirmation presentation starts with a timeline. So that's what you have in front of you. Your Honor, this has not been an easy process. Sorry, someone's calling me. This has not been an easy process. We started Chapter 11 cases on what I called at the time odd footing. That was at our first day of our three-day-long first-day hearing way back in early June. Don't think too hard about that one. And we had started the cases by filing a voluntary petition for the subsidiary debtor, Sunnova TEP Developer, really without any sort of press release or first-day papers. We did that filing to help preserve potentially valuable preference claims, but it was an inauspicious beginning, to be sure. Now, a week later, we filed the other three debtors along with some first-day papers, but our work wasn't done. When we ultimately had our first-day hearing, the debtors did not yet have a dip, or a stalking horse did. Instead, the debtors had about $13.5 million of cash on hand that was not cash collateral, and two private sale motions to sell certain non-core assets for about $15 million each. That was progress, to be sure, but to put the situation in context, we had a company with nearly $9 billion of debt, funded debt, across the debtors and the non-debtors in the structure, and we had very little cash. The situation, I'll tell you now, it was dire, but we collectively put on a brave face, and I told you, Your Honor, at the first hearing that there would be no flashy first-day presentation decks. Instead, we were going to take these cases in bite-sized pieces to do the best we can under the circumstances. That first hearing, Judge, was a long one, one I won't soon forget. You heard the evidence on one of the sale motions, and I think, if I'm reading the room correctly, somewhat reluctantly approved that first sale, understanding the situation was very unique, and we needed the cash. But at the risk of being dramatic, that decision really set the stage for us to start to right-size the situation and move the debtors from odd footing to something much better. And as we moved from, you know, left to right on this timeline, things did start to come into place, and we did continue to take them in bite-sized pieces. So during the course of the rest of that week in June, the debtors were able to reach agreement on a dip from a group of bondholders. It also included a credit bid that would support a sale process as a stalking horse. That dip, it reflected very important concessions from the dip lenders, including an agreement that the sale process would be on a rational 45-day timeline and that the dip collateral would exclude a pocket of valuable unencumbered assets that we refer to as the new home WIP. We also reached the first of what became several agreements with Atlas, working with Mr. Kolodny. He was the agent of the warehouse facility at the non-debtor entity TEP Holdings and its subsidiaries. That was another very important step in these cases because that created a path forward to potentially and now actually unlock huge recoveries for the dealers who were owed several hundred million dollars. So I took a bit of a flyer at the end of our third day of the first day hearing in June, and I said somewhat optimistically that, you know, the company was on firm footing. The professionals all went home after that week. We had a good night's sleep, and we immediately got back to work. There was so much to do, and we've been really busy ever since. A few of the major items we've accomplished along the way during the intervening months. So following the appointment of the committee on June 18th, we immediately jumped into a dialogue with them about the terms of the final DIP order. And as you all will remember, the final DIP order had as a condition to it a release by the debtors of KKR that was needed as part of the stalking horse bid for a whole host of reasons, including tax reasons. We were able to achieve entry of the final DIP order on a consensual basis with the committee. And I think that was, looking back at it, I think it was a huge milestone and a point of optimism, at least for me, because it showed that the parties in the cases had the will and the drive to be commercial and thoughtful and not spend unnecessary money on legal fees fighting about things that we can resolve consensually. Again, after that order was entered, that set us up to have the auction for the sale, which we did have. The auction began July 23rd, and the sale order was entered on July 31st. The sale ultimately closed on September.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Third, following a very difficult process for approval by holders of several billion dollars of ABS debt within the asset co structure that was being sold. The stalking horse purchaser did end up buying the assets, but only after the auction process resulted in a material increase in the value of the transaction of just under $20 million. Again, we achieved agreement with the committee on the terms of the sale order, and we ultimately saved approximately 400 jobs and continued service for 400,000 customers approximately. We could just jump down to the next slide, please. In fact, Your Honor, since the petition date, we have executed on more than 6 transactions with various counterparties that have resulted in significant cash proceeds to the debtor. The specter of administrative insolvency that perhaps has hung over these cases for at least some of the process, we can say today with confidence that the debtors are administratively solvent. And all told, since the initial petition was filed, over $100 million of incremental value has been negotiated and or monetized through the hard work of the debtors' management team, the purchasers slash dip lenders, Alice, the UCC, their collective advisors, and I would be remiss if I didn't call especially Mr. Alejandro, the debtor's CRO, who has worked relentlessly and tirelessly to maximize the value for the estates. Judge, this is all stuff you've been sort of privy to, quick summation of how we got here. I want to talk a little bit about what has happened since Your Honor conditionally approved the disclosure statement on September 12th, more than 8 weeks ago, I'm almost embarrassed to say. I'm sure you've wondered a little bit what's going on behind the scenes, and I want to give you a little bit of a peek of how we've used that time. Let's start with the committee judge, represented by the advisors of Wilkie and Blank Rum and BRG. You may remember, Your Honor, at the conditional disclosure statement, we heard a bit from Mr. Jenkins and Wilkie on behalf of the committee, who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the committee was not happy and that there was a lot that needed to be done if we were ever going to have a consensual confirmation. He even went so far as to say that Your Honor should expect objections, discovery spikes, and depositions. It was a shot across the bow, to be sure. Now, I have a lot of professional respect for Mr. Jenkins, so it was a hard speech to hear that day. We had come so far in these cases, but it was clear that we had so much that we had to do to finish these cases efficiently and effectively. We on the debtor side took Mr. Jenkins' comments, his shot across the bow, not as a declaration of war, but rather an invitation to see if we could work that much harder to find peace, and that's what we did for the last 8 weeks. Your Honor probably always hears the phrase hard-fought negotiations all the time. Everyone throws it out. It's in all the papers. Let me tell you, that phrase is an understatement here when it comes to the plan that we are seeking to confirm today. Finding a way to peace and resolution required every party to stick with it and not let discussions become overly emotional or descend into chaos. And the level of professionalism that parties carried out here is very extraordinary. And we thank everyone for participating in it the way they did. I frankly wasn't sure at times that we would get there, especially on very difficult questions about the appropriateness of things like releases and the formation of the creditor trust and what would go in the trust, but we did. It took us 8 weeks. Frankly, it took us more than 8 weeks because we started before the DS, but we did it. And I applaud everyone for sticking with it, not just with Kirkland and Ellis and working with A&M and Kirkland, but working with the advisors at Cobrain, Kim, and Province who represent the special committee of two interested directors, Mr. Tony Horton and Mr. Jeff Stein. I believe that, there is a world where lesser professionals would have spent a lot of unnecessary time and money in these cases on litigation, and that credit recoveries would have been all the worse for it. But that's not where we're at. We're here on a largely consensual basis, if not fully consensual basis, other than with the U.S. trustee, and people have worked really hard to get there since September 12th. I also want to talk a little bit, Your Honor, about the purchaser under the Holdco sale, who works with Paul Weiss, Norton Rose, and Evercore. As I mentioned, we came to these cases with a very complex, large capital structure, and doing a sale around that structure was not easy, very complicated. We all were moving very quickly, and while we did our collective best to dot every I and cross every T with respect to the Holdco sale, it probably was inevitable that at some point there would be a dispute about the sale once the sale closed. That's exactly what happened, and Your Honor has seen this time and time again. I'm sure the dispute was pretty simple. The purchaser had a view about what the debtors owed it, and the debtors had a view about what the purchaser owed them, and they weren't the same. It's a story you've probably heard a lot. That dispute itself could have devolved into, frankly, complete chaos, resulting in motion practice discovery, and at least one adversary proceeding was threatened. But all of the principals and professionals approached the dispute in a patient and rational manner, and that resulted in a comprehensive resolution that is now built into the plan and which will bring in an incremental $8,376,000 into the debtor's estate. So it's a net positive to the debtors without having to spend incremental professional fees getting to the right answer. So we thank the professionals and the principals involved for getting to the right answer there. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the plan, but that's a second area that's been hotly contested. The third vertical judge is within Atlas and the non-debtor entities that are obligated on the warehouse facility. You've heard a little bit from Allison's counsel from White & Case throughout the cases, and their financial advisor from Alex Partners, also leading the team, the charge of the team from McDermott, Will and Schulte, that you haven't heard from as much, but has been extremely helpful, that represents the board at the non-debtor entity TEP Holdings. It is a very complicated relationship between the debtors and the non-debtors, but the punchline here is that the various sale and settlement agreements that we've reached with TEP H, which is what we call it, ultimately unlocked hundreds of millions of dollars for over 100 dealer settlements and a path to a significant recovery for the TEP H warehouse lenders. We've also had a very consensual governance process within TEP H with Ms. Manoukian's help. Achieving peaceful resolution on the plan also required that we find agreement with those professionals because they had their own comments on the plan too. So we had to bring them into the fold and make sure they were comfortable with what we were doing. Of course, there have been one-off issues, some of which are very important, like the issues with the Department of Energy that we've been able to address over the course of the last 8 weeks and which are reflected in the plan and proposed order. But it's been a very busy stretch, Your Honor. I apologize for not having given an update on where we are, but frankly, we weren't sure it was going to come together. But it did, and you now have a sense of what we've been up to. It's been a long, hard road, but I strongly believe that we, the royal we on this call, folks, have really done all we could have done to maximize the value of the debtors' estates. And I say that with the most confidence I've ever had since I've been working on these cases, that the company's not just on firm footing at this point, but the plan that we're going to ask Your Honor to confirm today will put the debtors on the absolute best footing they could have been on, especially in light of the circumstances that led to the cases. So with that, Your Honor, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have or otherwise cede the podium to any other party that wishes to make a statement. Once that's done, we're going to move to our evidence and presentation in support of the disclosure statement. That's going to be led by Ms. Rainey with support from our colleague, Mr. Mike Coe.
All right. Does anyone wish to make brief remarks by way of opening? Go ahead, Mr. Jenkins. Oh, I don't think you have to hit 5-star. Anyone who wishes to speak, hit 5-star. I still haven't seen you, Mr. Jenkins. No, just hit 5-star one time.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Conference unmuted.
Okay, I unmuted you, so
yes.
But I had to unmute everybody because you didn't come up. So everyone, please mute their line.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that. It said my hand was raised, Your Honor, so I apologize.
Do you have anything they want to discuss?
Okay, yeah, we're going to have to do the 5-star again. There's just too much background noise, so why don't you go ahead and let me mute this and then hit 5-star. Just hit 5-star one time.
Conference muted. Conference unmuted.
All right. Just go ahead and Mr. Jenkins will mute it after you speak.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. It said my hand was raised. I apologize. Not sure what I'm doing wrong here. But I want to thank Mr. Schartz for his preview and also just give you a quick update on where the committee is. As Mr. Schartz pointed out, there was real risk of administrative insolvency here. And as a committee, we wanted to be very sure that we took the right approach to maximizing value, and which took a careful balance constantly to make sure that we were making the right decisions, both from how fees would be spent in this case and how we would ultimately maximize value. And as Mr. Schartz pointed out, this case started out with a number of emergency hearings and eventually the sale of substantially all the assets. And it became clear through time that really the only value for general unsecured creditors would come down to causes of action. And as Mr. Schartz pointed out, through really hard-fought negotiations, we did come to a place on the plan that turns over that value to the general unsecured creditors, both in terms of the ability to control that destiny and how that pursuit occurs. And as I'm sure will be pointed out, that plan now provides a liquidating trust. The general unsecured creditors through the UCC have selected a trustee who will oversee that trust. And there's an oversight board with four general unsecured creditors selected by the UCC who will now take over the reins, so to speak, of maximizing the value of that remaining, those remaining assets. Equally important is that this plan and the disclosure statement now projects that we will have sufficient money not only to wind down the debtor estates, but also fund the start of the pursuit of those causes of action, both in terms of investigation and, where necessary, litigation. And I want to point out also that through the creditor trust agreement, while we think we may have enough money to start that process, it's, as Your Honor knows, it's not always clear at the beginning where that may go. But the creditor trust agreement that we've agreed upon and that's in the plan supplement will also give the creditor trustee, with the consent of the oversight board, the ability to obtain litigation financing if needed, which could include loans, contingency arrangements, and insurance. So we will have the resources, general unsecured creditors will have the resources to pursue those causes of action one way or another. And that really came in part, as well as Mr. Schartz pointed out, fighting to limit the scope of the releases, which took, you know, a lot of effort. But we got comfortable, one, as you would expect, that there's no release of fraud, gross negligence, or willful misconduct. But further, we've now retained avoidance actions and causes of action against virtually all the pre-petition officers, directors, advisors, third parties, with only very minor exceptions, so that the full scope of what happened here can be investigated and pursued and if necessary, litigated to maximize value. And that includes also through the retention of insurance policies. So a lot of work went into making sure that this liquidating trust would have access to pursue causes of action, standing to pursue those, and also reach to insurance. And lastly, I would say we also work to make sure for third-party releases that there will be an extension of time for creditors out there who didn't yet have the chance to opt out. They will have, I believe, to December 10th, an additional notice time to opt out of those releases. So there will be additional notice for those creditors to take a look at that and opt out. So in the end, Your Honor, while I can't say we've made lemonade out of lemons here, at least the lemons are being turned over to a trust and we'll be able to pursue the remaining causes of action in a way that makes sense from the committee standpoint and hopefully from the general and all general unsecured creditors. And I will just add that it did take a lot of work with a lot of professionals focusing on being professional, focused on pushing and fighting where necessary, but not fighting where it was unnecessary. And I thank everyone for their work on that and for your attention to this, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else wish to be heard by way and make sure of an opening statement? Uh, Mr. Sharks.
Okay, I'm actually going to kick it to Ms. Rainey in New York, who's going to present the case in chief. So, Ms. Rainey, take it away.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Margaret Rainey of Kirkland & Ellis, counsel for the debtors. As Mr. Sharks mentioned, we're thrilled to be here today, seeking final approval of the disclosure statement and confirmation of the plan. At the outset, I would like to start with a summary of the evidence in support of confirmation today and the admission of the documents embodying the evidence. Your Honor, we submitted and filed with the court a number of declarations in support of confirmation. The first is that of the Chief Restructuring Officer, Mr. Ryan Omohundro, filed at docket number 1179. Mr. Omohundro's declaration addresses the 1129 factors as well as evidence in support of the releases. The second declaration is that of Mr. Jeffrey Stein, a disinterested director on the debtors board, having served since April of this year. His declaration is at docket number 1180 and addresses the special committee of the board's investigation. Finally, we have the declaration of Mr. Alex Orchowski from Kroll, the debtors' claims and noticing agent. That was filed at docket number 1182 and outlines the voting and solicitation process. Your Honor, all of these declarants are present via Zoom today, and I would ask at the outset that these declarations be admitted as the declarant's direct testimony in support of confirmation.
All right, let's take them one at a time. So with respect to Mr. Omohundro's declaration at docket number 1179, does anyone oppose the admission of Mr. Omohundro's declaration as his direct testimony in connection with this case subject to cross-examination? All right, hearing no objection, they will be admitted. I do have one question. So, Mr. Omohundro, would you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
All right, my only question is, your declaration had a conversion date of October 17th. We're almost a month later. With respect to the liquidation analysis, would your testimony be the same as the conversion date for today as opposed to October 17th?
It would.
All right. I have nothing further. Does anyone wish to cross-examine? All right. Thank you, Mr. Omohundro.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Your declaration is admitted. Next is the declaration of Mr. Stein at docket number 1180. Does anyone object to the admission of the declaration of Mr. Stein as his direct testimony for purposes of this hearing subject to cross-examination? All right, hearing no objection, that will be admitted. And finally, we have the declaration of Mr. Oshowski at docket number 1182. Does anyone object to the admission of the declaration of Mr. Oshowski as his direct testimony in connection with this hearing subject to cross-examination? Okay, hearing no objection, his declaration at docket 1182 will be admitted. Go ahead, Ms. Rainey.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the debtors assert that the disclosure statement contains adequate information as presented in the confirmation brief, and no party has asserted otherwise. The debtors have complied with the applicable solicitation requirements set place in the conditional disclosure statement order and required under Section 1125 of the Bankruptcy Code. Kroll, the debtor's claims and noticing agent, sent out approximately 8,000 solicitation packages to the voting classes, and approximately 37,500 non-voting notices to other claim holders. Further, the debtors submit that all parties were provided ample notice to return such materials. When there was a question as to whether the debtors had met the required voting thresholds, the debtors extended voting deadlines for classes 3 and 5 and utilized the flexibility afforded by the solicitation procedures to allow parties to change their votes as necessary to achieve the consensus reflected in the voting report. Your Honor, we believe that the process worked as it should have, in no small part due to Your Honor's approval of the conditional disclosure statement order and the efforts of Kroll. Accordingly, unless Your Honor has any questions regarding the disclosure statement, the debtors respectfully request that the court approve the disclosure statement on a final basis at the conclusion of the hearing.
All right, let's take that piece right now. Does anyone wish to be heard with respect to the final approval of the disclosure statement? All right, thank you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Andrew Jimenez for the United States Trustee. I guess my only remark will be also in connection with confirmation of the plan. As the U.S. Trustee objected earlier in this case, Your Honor, to the opt-out mechanism, with the understanding that the opt-out mechanism was not appropriate in this case because you don't get the appropriate consent from creditors. So in that respect, which connects to confirmation of the plan, I just want to raise that issue, Your Honor, so that it's not forgotten or considered as waiving that right as it relates to the disclosure statement, but I think it's more it fits more appropriately with confirmation of the plan.
All right, thank you. That'll be noted. All right, go ahead, Ms. Rainey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Moving to the plan, I will spare the court a lengthy recitation and discussion of each of the 1129 factors, none of which I believe are in dispute today. I would just note that these factors are addressed in detail in Mr. Omohundro's declaration and in our confirmation brief. I will focus my presentation on the revisions that we've made to the plan since solicitation and the objections. As Your Honor saw, we made a number of revisions to the plan, all of which we believe are technical modifications that do not give rise to resolicitation. My colleague, Mike Coe, will walk Your Honor through the confirmation order in detail, but at a high level, we made the following changes. We disclosed the identity of the creditor trustee and the initial members of the creditor trust oversight board. We made several changes to clarify that causes of action vesting in the creditor trust will not include any released claims. We added the purchaser settlement, which, as Mr. Schartz noted, brings an incremental $8.376 million into the debtor's estate. We clarified the scope of the debtor release and third-party release, as well as the definitions as the released and releasing parties. Your Honor, as Mr. Schartz mentioned, these changes were heavily negotiated with the committee, advisors to the special committee, the DIP ad hoc group, and several other of the debtor's stakeholders, and were scrutinized very closely given that this is a liquidating plan and there will be no discharge in these cases. The definitions of released and releasing parties, as revised, are narrowly tailored to capture those who contributed significant value to the debtor's estate in these Chapter 11 cases, and the scope of released parties was informed by and is consistent with the results of the independent special committee investigation.
I have a question there, though. I believe, if I read correctly, that the debtor is a released party. I don't understand how the debtor can be a released party.
Your Honor, the debtor is a released party in that we took the temporal limitation that Your Honor noted at the disclosure statement hearing, and it's only being released for the period between the petition date and the effective date.
If that's the case, I missed it, but where is that in the plan?
Your Honor. Let's see. Your Honor, I'm looking at Article 8 of the plan, Section C.
Right.
So towards the bottom of that paragraph, it notes, the confirmation order shall only release claims and causes of action against the debtors and their related parties solely to the extent the claims arise from the period between the petition date and ending on the effective date.
Okay, all right.
There is a limited carve-out there for the release directors and officers and the debtors' professionals. We took Your Honor's comments out of the conditional disclosure statement and added that limited carve-out solely for protection of those parties, but that was the only change we made with respect to Your Honor's ruling at the disclosure statement hearing.
Okay, which paragraph is it in? Because when I read the start, oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
Sorry,
all right.
Very
I missed that. Sorry. Yeah, I missed that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, you'll also see in this paragraph and in the releases generally that there is a new defined term called specified releasing parties. Those parties, through negotiations with the debtors and the committee, agree to release the debtors and their related parties for the pre-petition period as part of a settlement of plan issues that set the table today for the consensual hearing. These specified releasing parties also agreed that they will not offensively seek recovery against the debtors' D&O policies, except for one lender group. They will not pursue pre-petition claims against lenders. Again, Your Honor, this was one piece of the broader settlement that enabled the parties to come before Your Honor with a consensual plan. And from the debtor's perspective, the releases in the plan are appropriate and consensual, consistent with Fifth Circuit law. Your Honor, in a similar vein, you likely saw the schedule of non-released parties that was included in the plan supplement.
Right.
This is a rather novel concept in form, but not really in substance. Given that this is a liquidating plan and the creditor trustee will be looking into claims against non-released parties for the benefit of its beneficiaries, we decided to create a schedule noting the parties that were explicitly not released.
This call is no longer being recorded.
To be clear, we're not saying that the parties on that schedule have claims that are being reserved, but rather that these parties are expressly not being released by the plan. And if there is a colorable claim against them or their respective related parties, then the plan doesn't bar an action against those parties.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
As to the debtor's objections, we received 19 formal objections and a number of informal objections for language in the plan or confirmation order. We have worked with each of the parties that submitted either formal or informal objections, and many of the comments have been reflected in the documents filed with the court to that effect. there are a few general categories of objections outstanding. The first are a series of pro se objectors. We received 9 formal objections and 1 informal objection to confirmation, among other outreach not really related to confirmation, from various pro se parties, largely alleging servicing, installation, or billing disputes. Given that the debtors have sold substantially all of the estate to Solaris, the debtors have worked to connect each of these pro se objectors with appropriate personnel at SunStrong, which has taken over the management of the customer systems and contracts. I will note, to the extent that these objectors sought to opt out of the plan's releases, we also coordinated with Kroll to ensure that they were reflected in the opt-out tabulation. We don't believe that any of these objections raise a colorable confirmation issue or directly implicate the 1129 factors. Your Honor, the second category of objectors are those of the dealers associated with the DOE Puerto Rico Resilience Fund. As Your Honor likely remembers from the first day hearing, we have sought from the beginning to ensure that these dealers continue to receive reimbursements under the DOE fund. We have been negotiating final payments for these dealers and the termination of that program with counsel for the DOE directly. The dealers that operate within that program filed objections to confirmation, but we have included language in the confirmation order noting the proposed resolution for this program and reserving parties' rights, and in any event, do not believe that those arguments relate to confirmation of the plan.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Conference muted. Conference unmuted.
Your Honor,
yes.
Let me move with the U.S. trustee's objection, which largely focuses on the plan's third-party release, which I will focus the rest of my presentation on. Your Honor, to start with the debtor release, no party has specifically objected to it, but I think that the context supporting that release is really important here. The special committee of the board is comprised of 2 disinterested directors and was formed in April of this year. The special committee and those directors and advisors reviewed potential estate causes of action and claims and conducted a thorough investigation into those claims that the debtors may hold. As noted in the Stein Declaration, the Special Committee advisors reviewed approximately 20,000 responsive documents, conducted or participated in 38 interviews, and reviewed extensive financial information, ultimately culminating in a 100-page report that was presented to both the committee and the DIP ad hoc group. The Special Committee ultimately determined that the scope of the debtor release is appropriate. For these reasons, we believe that the debtor release is a reasonable exercise of the Special Committee's business judgment, especially when viewed as a piece of the comprehensive whole. Your Honor, as to the third-party release, I have 2 observations generally. First, all of the releasing parties were given the opportunity to opt out of the releases. Given the receipt of 543 opt-outs, I would say that that opt-out process was successful. As this court noted at the container store hearing, the major goal and major inquiry that the court has to make is, was this a process that was fair and intended to get notice to people so that they can make a decision? And I think the answer to that question here is emphatically yes. All parties were at least provided the opportunity to opt out in that notice, which was approved by this court at the conditional disclosure statement hearing and drafted with the input of the various stakeholders. Kroll did an incredible job of seeking to locate and serve all stakeholders to ensure that parties were afforded the opportunity to opt out. Further, given the multiple adjournments of the confirmation hearing, we continue to accept opt-outs even past the deadline. It is very difficult to argue, based on the evidence in the voting report, that the debtors did not adequately provide notice with respect to the opt-out process. In our view, this process worked exactly as it was intended, and the opt-outs are an indication of such. Moreover, as previously noted, the debtors granted several extensions of the voting deadline, with respect to classes 3 and 5 in pursuit of a consensual plan. Through that process, we were alerted that there were some issues that certain holders were having in opting out and simultaneously accepting the plan. We worked with the committee advisors and their clients to ensure that any party that notified us of the desire to opt out was relayed to Kroll and recorded on the opt-out notice. Opt-out tabulation. However, as an added measure, the debtors determined it would be prudent to extend that opt-out deadline and send a supplemental opt-out form to parties in the voting classes, that's classes 3, 4, and 5, to ensure that they have the opportunity to opt out. We have proposed 30 days from today as the extended opt-out deadline, subject to Your Honor's approval. Second, as Your Honor noted, since Pacific Lumber, no non-consensual third-party releases have been approved in the Fifth Circuit. Instead, there are refined ways to determine whether releases are consensual, and that is through notice and opt-out. The Supreme Court was clear in Purdue, noting that nothing in that opinion should call into question consensual third-party releases, and the debtors agree with that assertion. The debtors believe that the uncontroverted evidence presented by Mr. Orchowski, including the number of affidavits of service and extensive noticing efforts, show that this process worked and parties were effectively given the opportunity to opt out of these releases. We believe that the debtors' process and the releases are in line with those approved post-Purdue, including Vroom, Robert Shaw, Independence, Drilling, and Plenty, just to name a few. The debtors submit that the thorough pre-confirmation opt-out process, especially as enhanced with the post-confirmation supplemental process, goes above and beyond the bare minimum and has truly achieved a consensual opt-out third-party release. Finally, the U.S. trustee takes issue with the exculpated parties definition, the injunction provision, and the waiver of the 14-day stay. As to the former, both the exculpation provision and the 1125E exculpated parties definition are narrowly tailored to include parties that were actively involved in these Chapter 11 cases. As noted earlier with respect to the debtor release, the special committee has been extremely instrumental in these cases. Not only did they conduct the investigation, but as noted in the first day declaration, they were delegated broad authority to analyze and consider any transaction in conflict matter. At times through these cases, they were consulted multiple times a week. And given that management resigned at the close of sale on September 3rd, the special committee and the CRO, Mr. Omohondro, have been acting as fiduciaries for the debtors for the estate. We believe that the exculpated parties provisions are consistent with other cases approved in the district post-Highland, such as Desktop Metal, Global Clean Energy, and Instant Brands, among others. The injunction provisions, including the post-effective date litigation injunctions, here are also consistent with Highland 1 and Highland 2. The injunction provision is a standard injunction preventing parties subject to consensual releases from pursuing release claims, and it's necessary to enforce those releases. The post-effective date litigation injunctions are narrow additional enforcement mechanisms specifically to protect estate causes of action that vest in the creditor trust and to enforce the exculpation in favor of the exculpated parties. With respect to the 14-day stay of effectiveness, it is no secret, and Mr. Schartz noted, that these cases have been concerned with liquidity since the petition date. The debtors are conscious that every minute spent by the debtors' professionals and all other professionals takes money away from the beneficiaries of the creditor trust, and the debtors would assert that cause exists to justify the 14-day stay waiver. With that, I would conclude my argument as to the case.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
And reserve time for any responses, Your Honor.
Other than Mr. Jimenez, does anyone else wish to be heard in opposition to confirmation? Yes, go ahead, Mr. Sosa.
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
I can.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Etika Sosa. Okay, I'm on it. I have two contracts, one energized and one unenergized. I file a supplemental motion to enforce the self-order and Section 365B. May I be here briefly on narrow interim release, please?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Respectfully, three business day identification to the assignee servicer and an authorized signatory for my lines. The status quo, no activation of the unenergized line and no adverse credit or collection on dispute amounts. 3 7-day minimal data, monthly billing, AC deduction consumption, and poor quality loss with short status. If that debtors contend, the purchaser control this. Please order debtors to cost those items for the same timetable.
All right, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and mute again because we're still getting a lot of background noise. If everyone could mute. So,
conference muted. Conference unmuted.
Okay. I don't know. We're having some problems here. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sosa. Just out of the. All right. Mr. Ortega?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me, sir?
Yes, good. Yes, I can.
All right. My name is Daniel Ortega, a pro se creditor with claim number 1473. I'm appearing on my docketed motion for sanctions and rescission. I just wanted permission to speak on that.
Go ahead.
Basically with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, I sent in a validation of debt, gave 15 days, calendar days to get that back. I never received anything on it, no response whatsoever. So to me, that's a refusal to validate. They never validated but took two post-debits afterwards. They debited me $623.70 on September 9th and on October 8th. So under the CPA, $1692K, that's $1,000 per debit there for the violations. So I'm asking for that. And then there's no cure, so to reject the PPA.
All right. Thank you. All right, anyone else wish to be heard in opposition to confirmation? Oh, I know, Mr. Jimenez, I'll come to you. All right, Mr. Jimenez.
Thank you, Your Honor. Andrew Jimenez for the United States Trustee. Your Honor, before I move forward with my objection, I would like to just do a quick cross-examination to Mr. Orzowski regarding the tabulation of votes.
Okay. Mr. Orzowski, are you available? Can you turn on your camera?
Yes, I'm available. Just turned on the camera.
Okay. Did you raise your right hand, sir?
Yes.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Jimenez.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Orzowski. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Good morning.
Good morning. Ms. Roszewski, did you listen a moment ago? A debtor's counsel informed the court that the debtors receive approximately 543 opt-outs from creditors?
Yes, I heard that.
Okay, and you agree with that number? The number is correct?
Yes.
Okay, could you tell the court how many ballots with an opt-out form were sent out to creditors?
Well, there was approximately 8,000 ballots that were sent out with the opt-out box included on a ballot, and I believe it was referenced in the presentation by Ms. Rainey. There were also approximately 35,500 non-voting notices and opt-out forms sent to non-voting classes as well.
I'm sorry, you said 35,000 or 3,500?
35,000. 35,500.
Gotcha. Okay, and of all those ballots for creditors and also all those forms, non-voting forms that were sent out, how many were returned undeliverable?
I'm not sure. I don't have that number right now.
Okay. Can you tell the court if any of those ballots and non-voting forms were returned undeliverable?
I can't right now. I'd have to check with my team and revert. I don't have that information right now.
Do you have a breakdown from the 543 opt-outs that were received? Do you have a breakdown as to how many of those were from voting creditors and how many were from non-voting parties?
That information can be found in my declaration. I don't have the counts as I right now, but it can be, you know, it can be discerned from the exhibits.
Will it help you if we pull up your declaration to find out?
Sure.
Okay. Your Honor, if I could have the presenter roll. Okay. Can you see my screen, Mr. Roszewski?
Yes.
Okay. Is this big enough, or would you like me to enlarge the image?
This is fine.
Okay. So where should we go in your declaration to find out that information?
So it'd be exhibits C1 and C2, so the last two exhibits of the declaration.
Okay.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Okay. This is C1?
Yes.
Okay. Where would you like me to go? Should I keep scrolling down?
Yeah, so Mr. Jimenez, it's like, I guess I don't have the number. I guess of the 543, I'd be estimating if I told you how many, like, general unsecured claims I see just based on, like, the number of rows included in that page. I would, if I pulled up the Excel exhibits and not the PDF form, I could get a count of the number by class. But just looking at the pages, I'd kind of be guesstimating as to how many. As you can see from C1, it looks like a large majority are from the general unsecured claimants, with a handful coming from the non-voting classes. And then in this C2 has the public securities holders that are in classes 3, 5, and 8. And I believe that most of the opt-outs included on this exhibit are from holders in classes 3 and 5, with a handful also coming from the holders in class 8.
Okay. Those are all the questions I have for you, Mr. Ostrowski. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Now, let me just move to summarize the issues that I think still remain, Your Honor. And I'm going to start by what I think should be the easiest one, because I think we had our conversations with the debtor and to find the appropriate language to address this issue. So we requested the debtor to include a language. It's not in the plan, at least in the confirmation order, regarding preserving the police and regulatory powers of governmental units and making sure that confirmation of the plan would not discharge claims of governmental units. And to that effect, I believe that the debtor's incorporated language in the proposed confirmation order that was filed last night at docket 1188. However, in paragraph 117, Your Honor, I think there is a sentence that I think pokes a big hole into that provision. I've earlier this morning, I requested the debtor to make a notification to paragraph 117. I think they have agreed to that, Your Honor, and to that extent that they make that verification, then that issue is resolved. But I just want to make the court aware that what was filed last night, it still needs a small modification in paragraph 117.
All right, before you go on, Ms. Rainey, is that, I'm looking at 117 right now, is that acceptable to the debtor?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Okay, and which sentence is it, Mr. Jimenez?
So, Your Honor, if you look at 117, if you look at the second half, when it starts, it reads, provided that the bankruptcy court retains jurisdiction to determine whether environmental liabilities asserted by any governmental unit or other entity are discharged or otherwise barred by the plan or related plan documents, this confirmation order, any other order relating to the debtor or the bankruptcy code.
Okay, I see. And so that X would be taken out.
Correct, Your Honor. And to be specific, the X will be taken out.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Could everyone please mute their phones? I don't know, we're having a problem.
Conference muted. Conference unmuted.
All right, go ahead, Mr. Jimenez. I'm sorry. It's just background noise.
Okay, Your Honor. Your Honor, the plan, the amended plan has two different categories of exculpated parties. And I'm going to start with the first one, which is it's called 1125E exculpated party. So my objection to that category of 1125E exculpated parties is that it's not narrowly tailored, Your Honor. It includes related parties. I object to the inclusion of related parties in that definition of what otherwise would be the 1125E exculpated parties, because those related parties, Your Honor, are not fully identified. We don't know who they are. It's a broad definition that would include a lot of people that we simply don't know who they are. So my objection is that related parties should be removed from that definition of 1125E exculpated parties. And I want to move on now to exculpated parties, which is a different category in the plan. And in the exculpated parties, Your Honor, our objection is that it includes the definition of exculpated parties includes the special committee. Our position is that the inclusion of the special committee is not authorized under Highland Capital, Your Honor, and we are requesting that the special committee be removed from that definition of exculpated parties. Under Highland Capital, Your Honor, directors or independent directors can only receive an exculpation under very specific circumstances that we had in Highland Capital, which we don't have here, Your Honor. And I don't think under Fifth Circuit precedent, the debtors are authorized to give exculpations to the special committee. Finally, last but not least, Your Honor, we reiterate our objection to the opt-out mechanism, Your Honor. That objection has been fully briefed previously, so I'm not going to take the court's time reciting that again, Your Honor, but we have concerns about the parties that will be subject to the third-party releases giving appropriate consent. Debtors' counsel, in their arguments, stated to the court that the opt-out mechanism was successful because the debtor received 543 opt-outs. I would submit to the court, Your Honor, that we've only received a very small number of opt-outs out of a very large universe of creditors and non-voting parties that are able to participate in the opt-out. Over 8,000 ballots for voting creditors were sent out with an opt-out mechanism, and 35,500 were sent to non-voting parties. So we have over 42,000 opt-out forms were sent out, Your Honor, and we only received back 543. That is a very small number. That is a very small participation, and I don't think that shows that the opt-out mechanism is successful or appropriate in this type of case, Your Honor. I know the committee has reached a settlement with the debtors and are approving the plan, Your Honor. But if you remember back when we were discussing...
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
The disclosure statement, the conditional approval of the disclosure statement, the committee raised the concern that the opt-out mechanism was not appropriate and that it should have been an opt-in mechanism. Our objection was a little different, Your Honor, but I think I just mentioned it to illustrate that those concerns about the opt-out mechanism, I think, still remain and are still objectionable at this stage. So that's all I have for the court this morning, and thank you for the opportunity and for listening, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good. Okay. Thank you. All right. If no one else wishes to be heard in opposition, go ahead, Ms. Rainey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to take Mr. Jimenez's comments in turn, first to the scope of the 1125E exculpated parties definition. That definition notes that the related parties are only included to the extent permitted under Section 1125E of the Bankruptcy Code. So I believe that proviso substantially narrows the scope of this definition and should be considered appropriate. As to the special committee, I will rely on my previous statements as to all of the work that has been done by the special committee And I believe that similar definitions have been approved by Your Honor in courts in this district. As to the scope of the opt-outs, I don't believe that there is a numerical threshold that's required to show that opt-outs are consensual. Not only were opt-outs formed broadly populated to the voting classes and non-voting classes, but there was a publication notice filed in the New York Times, the Financial Times, and the San Juan Daily News. So, Your Honor, I would submit that contrary to Mr. Jimenez's assertions, these opt-outs were indeed consensual and will be further bolstered by the supplemental opt-out notices that will be sent after this hearing if Your Honor approves it. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
All right. Anyone else wish to be heard?
Yes, Your Honor. Henry Cavain.
Yes, Mr. Cavain. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I had two. I don't know what happened to him.
I just wanted to follow up on Ms. Rainey's introduction about the DOE resolution and the concerns dealers had. Just like Mr. Schart started his presentation with kind of a timeline of what happened in this case, there was a similar timeline with respect to the dealers' concerns about the DOE program and the dealers' reimbursements under that program. As you may recall, at various points in the case, orders were entered, and they were all intended to protect the dealers' rights to reimbursement at various stages of the case. The debtors agreed to honor their obligations under the program and fulfill their obligations.
Do you want this? You have to use them.
And can everyone please mute their lines? Please. Go ahead, Mr. Cavain. I'm sorry, but can everyone please mute their lines? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And yet, as we approach confirmation, my client, Winmar, was still owed millions of dollars under the DOE program on account of many hundreds of completed projects. And our concern was simply that getting to this point of confirmation, we just did not want the debtors to exit stage left without fulfilling their ongoing obligations to reimburse us. And we've been working very hard with the Department of Energy and the debtors and the other dealers affected by this to reach a letter agreement that is between Mr. Omohundro on behalf of the debtors, the Department of Energy, and the affected dealers in Puerto Rico, under which the debtors will continue, notwithstanding confirmation, notwithstanding the effectiveness of the plan, to upload the documentation that entitles the dealers to reimbursements from the DOE program, the DOE's remittances once they're passed down to the debtors' bank accounts as the recipient of the award. The debtors have also will continue to process those payments for passing through to the dealers. So we believe, even though we're not quite there, we are hopeful we'll be able to execute that letter agreement today, but I wanted to give the court a little more context for the DOE resolution, and I thank you for your time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cavain. Does anyone else wish to be heard? All right. Before me is final approval of the disclosure statement and the confirmation of the debtor's plan. I have a few comments, and then I'll issue my ruling. I have a question, Ms. Rainey, with respect to the ability to assume or reject executory contracts. And the old paragraph 37 and 128 of the confirmation order. I know it's been amended now again, and so my concern is the situation where someone supports the plan thinking that their contract is going to be assumed and there's no cure dispute, and then it's subsequently rejected. So I understand the situation where you're seeking to assume there's a cure dispute, and then the cure dispute comes out in a way that you don't like, and you can
and you can reject the contract. But I don't. What I don't want is the situation where you say you're going to assume there is no cure dispute, and then you subsequently reject the contract. So I just want to make clear that that is not the situation that you're talking about, because paragraph 37, and so the plan says all executory contracts are going to be rejected unless there's a pending motion to assume. So if there's a pending motion to assume a no cure dispute, then it should be assumed, and I don't think, and if they vote in favor of the plan, then it should be assumed. Otherwise, you know, I don't think it's fair or equitable at that point. So it's just a language change, and I just want to make sure that there isn't this, there appears to be a conflict there, or at least an ambiguity.
Understood, Your Honor, and we can add clarifying language to that effect.
Yeah. Okay. In paragraph 131 of the old confirmation order, the provision regarding remedies under Puerto Rico law, this is the consumer's rights under Puerto Rican law. I don't know how the opt-out concept works there. So it says under paragraph the old.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Paragraph 137, you know, that notwithstanding anything in the order, if any pre-petition obligations, regulatory determinations, administrative enforcements under Puerto Rico consumer contracts shall not be extinguished solely to the extent somebody timely opted out. I don't know what an opt-out has to do with this. The contracts were sold subject to 365-0, and whatever the rights are under 365-0, those rights are maintained, but this order shouldn't affect the sale order. So I don't understand how the opt-out mechanism works with respect to paragraph 131.
Yeah. Good morning, Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Great. Mike Coe, Kirkland & Ellis, on behalf of the debtors. So paragraph 131 regarding rights and remedies under Puerto Rico law is a mostly negotiated resolution of one of the informal pro se objections. Ms. Barrera had filed a number of pleadings on the docket. I'm not sure if she's on the call this morning, but we had communicated back and forth with her a few times, and we had asked her for some proposed language that would resolve her objection for the order. This is a resolution amongst us. We haven't been able to contact Ms. Barrera since we included this in the order to confirm that she signed off on it, but it's fairly close to what she had requested in the first place. So if there are revisions to the language that Your Honor would prefer we include, we're happy to do so. I believe the reference to the opt-out was simply to ensure, number one, that she was noted as having opted out, and number two, that it wouldn't interfere with the otherwise reservation of her rights as she requested.
All right. Yeah, so I would just take out solely as to holders claimed the timely opted out party releases and are not releasing parties. I would just take that out. And the sale order stands. There was the sale order gave broad relief subject to 365-0. All right. Then my last question, well, two others. So in paragraph 32 of the old confirmation order, talks about that the purchaser will fund the purchaser settlement fund, settlement amount, but then paragraph 171 of the confirmation order talks about purchaser settlement consideration. Is that the same thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So that's it. With respect to the
exculpation of the special directors, I think we should refer to Mr. Stein and Mr. Horton by name so there's no confusion.
We'll make that revision, Your Honor.
Okay. And then finally, as it relates to the extended opt-out, I think it would probably be more appropriate to extend it for 75 days past both the end of the government shutdown as well as the holidays, so that if you take it 75 days, it goes to the end of January. I think with that, I would feel comfortable that to the extent that there were any logistical issues, that those have been resolved.
We're happy to extend it, Your Honor.
All right. So, first of all, in terms of my ruling, I'm going to go ahead and grant final approval of the disclosure statement and confirm the plan. There are many pending motions in front of me filed by various individuals relating to requests to rescind amounts, to rescind contracts, to orders. Those matters will be handled in the ordinary course, and they're not impacted by this. The part of the issue, we had a hearing earlier this week where a consumer was objecting, wanting to have his panels removed, and basically the debtor has sold the business, and there's a third party who now owns those assets and has the ability to do that. So part of this is an issue of what relief I can grant. But that's not before me today. I'm not ruling on anything relating to the various motions that are in front of me. I'm really focused on the disclosure statement and the plan. And I do agree with Mr. Schartz. I often wondered, what road this case was going to take, especially at the start. But I'm happy that we were able to delay the confirmation hearing and end up with, substantial agreement among the parties. As it relates to the remaining objection by the U.S. trustee, number one, there's always a question as to if ballots are returned undeliverable, what the effect of that is. And I'm not ruling on that today. To the extent somebody did not receive notice in a constitutional fashion, that matter isn't before me, and I'm not making a ruling with respect to that. As it relates to the scope of the 1125E exculpation, there's two responses. One, Ms. Rainey indicated that it's only to the extent permitted by 1125E, and also the related party's definition is limited to anybody who would be liable in a derivative capacity through or liable as a result of the actions taken by the party that is named. So the related party is only liable if they're liable because of the actions taken by the other person. So in that sense, I think that the 1125E exculpation is appropriate. As it relates to the exculpation of the two independent directors, I do believe that they were acting in a fiduciary capacity. I think that under Island Capital, to the extent that a person is acting in an independent capacity that came in, performed a significant function in this case, and acted as a fiduciary, especially in light of the fact that, the debtor's management went with the purchaser, I think that they, with respect to the limited time period that's covered by the 1125, the exculpation, I think that those are appropriate. So on that basis, I'm going to overrule the trustee's objection. Finally, as it relates to the opt-out mechanism, I think that under the Fifth Circuit law, prior to Purdue, there was no thing as a non-consensual release. Here, you have a situation where the release is limited. It's been highly negotiated. There are various carve-outs. The debtor release is again limited to a very narrow period of time, relating to the period after the effect, after the confirmation, after the petition, but prior to the effective date. I think the scope in there is appropriately limited. And I do believe that under the circumstances and the fact that you did have, 543 people opt out and the extended opt-out period till for 75 days or till January 26th, I think all of those measures indicate that that the release was consensual, is consensual, and under Fifth Circuit case law is appropriate under the circumstances. This isn't a case where you're trying to get.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Something by people. I mean, this has been highly negotiated. This is probably one of the more extensive release with various carve-outs and different parties getting different things. And furthermore, the scope of what's not being released is significant and forms the basis of the committee resolution with the debtor. So under all of those circumstances, again, I'm going to overrule the trustee's objection with respect to the opt-out mechanism for the third-party release. And so with that, I think that I have ruled on everything. Is there anything that I haven't ruled on?
I think we're good, Your Honor. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. There, I also had on the docket for today a motion to quash a 2004 examination. Is that still on the docket, or it wasn't on the agenda? All right, that's Mr. Stark. That was your motion, but we'll not worry about that.
Is Mr. Shriver in the room in New York? Maybe that was something
he was dealing with. We can. Mr. Cohn just popped on. Whenever you want to have that, if that's still viable and you want to have it heard, just reach out to Mr. Laws.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. And so, Mr. Ortega, you raised your hand.
Yes, Your Honor. It's Jamie Ortega, Thursday Creditor, Claim 1473. I just want to confirm, so you're saying as far as the motion for sanctions and the stuff that I have filed will be ruled on later? So
it'll be ruled on. We'll schedule a hearing. And it will be ruled on at the time of the hearing.
Okay, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem.
Your Honor, all right, I could just one final matter.
Yes.
We have an exclusivity motion that hasn't been granted yet. I think with today's rulings, we can officially say there won't be any opposition to it. And so with Your Honor's leave, we'll file a CNO on that motion following this hearing and hopefully get that order entered.
Right. Okay. And also, with respect to the 14-day stay, that's what I knew I was missing something. With respect to the 14-day stay, I think in this case where, it did flirt with administrative insolvency, I think the quicker that you can stop the drain, the better. So I'm going to go ahead and waive this stay. I think that based on the evidence that was presented from the declarations of Mr. Alejandro, I think there's sufficient evidentiary basis in order to do that.
Thank you.
So, all right. Mr. Esquivel? Mr. Sosa?
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
So, in my case, you mentioned you're going to be ruling in a later date for those motions pending. Just want to make sure that if the plan goes effective, those, if the plan goes effective, those issues with consumer cases in our contract are not going to leave us, like, in a kind of unprotected. So that just want to make sure the fact that you ruled today, you know, on the plan doesn't affect us as the consumers.
Well, the plan grants certain relief to the debtor in order to do that. There is no discharge in the plan. And with respect to this paragraph 131, it says basically, notwithstanding anything to the contrary in the plan, any pre-petition obligations, regulatory determinations, or administrative enforcement relating to Puerto Rico consumer contracts shall not be extinguished or impair or released. That's what it says.
Thank you, Mr. Your Honor. So I'm located in New Jersey. I'm not sure if this is only related to Puerto Rico in this case. So,
yeah. So the order and perhaps the order, the sale order, reserved all of the 365 O rights, which were the consumer rights under the consumer contract. Whether in your case that's the case, I don't know. That's why I want to study it and read it up separately without.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Without making a decision. But
thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Mr. Sharp, anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a long road, and we appreciate it.
Okay. So, go ahead and just resubmit the confirmation order with a red line, and as well as the CNO on the other order, on the exclusivity extension, and I'll review that and get that entered. All right.
Got it.
So we'll be in recess to the 10:30. Thank you all.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.